Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
So, Epictetus, you think, died when Marcus Aurelius was aged roughly 15. And Marcus hadn't left Rome, and Epictetus had been exiled like a generation earlier and was living in Greece. So Marcus wouldn't have met Epictetus, but he would have known loads of teachers, older men, who probably had met Epictetus. Marcus Aurelius's main tutor was a guy called Junius Rusticus, his main Stoic tutor, his right-hand man, in fact. And we know from one really obscure source that Junius Rusticus seems to have served in the army alongside Arrian, who was the student who wrote down all of Epictetus' discourses. Epictetus wrote nothing.
Okay.
Like, all the discourses are written by one of his students called Arrian, who was a highly accomplished writer, prolific writer, and one of the most senior statesmen and generals under Hadrian, one of the preceding emperors. And so Arrian Junius Rusticus served in the war against the Alani, like in Armenia. And Junius Rusticus then came back to Rome. And Marcus Aurelius says at the beginning of the Meditations that one of the most seismic events in his life was that Junius Rusticus gave him a copy of notes from the lectures of Epictetus from his private library. Right. Now, why does he say from his private library? I think because of something that Arrian says in the preface he wrote to the discourses, which people usually don't pay that much attention to. Arrian says that the discourses were written down initially to be only circulated in private among a circle of his friends, and they were basically leaked and became public at some point.
Right.
I suspect Marcus Aurelius emphasizes that he got them from Junius Rusticus's private library because at that point, Marcus believed that Epictetus had written nothing and no record of his teaching survived. It would be like this amazing rock star, like the most famous guy in the world. You never got a chance. He died before you got a chance to ever go and see him perform. And then one day Junius Rusticus said, look, you seem to be really into Stoicism, kid. Like, let me show you something that nobody even knows exists. And he opened the cupboard and showed him eight volumes. Only half of them survived today, by the way. Marcus had read twice as many discourses of Epictetus. And that would have been like a huge collection of bootlegs.
Yeah.
Like, it must have blown his mind.
Yeah.
And so I think one of the reasons that Marcus became such a passionate follower of Epictetus is that he got this kind of VIP...
It's a symbolism as well, isn't it, of actually having that experience.
Yeah, you know, like, it must have been incredible. He would have been about 15 and thought, like, it's a shame that the most important teacher of philosophy never left any records. And then this guy one day says, I've got all these bootlegs. Like, I've got, like, volumes and volumes of recordings of his teachings. Like, you can have it.
It's probably like going through your life and having never heard the Beatles, but just having heard of them, and then suddenly someone finds an LP or something.
Collection. And so Marcus loves Epictetus, and he's the main philosopher that he quotes. And he's read more of Epictetus than we have. So, you know, even though they'd never met, Marcus is kind of, to a large extent, a sort of disciple of Epictetus. And that's why he quotes him and paraphrases from him in the Meditations.
Brilliant, brilliant. Okay. We've already chatted loads. I haven't really talked too much on Marcus's history in your book. I know we've touched on certain bits. Well, I do want to have a quick rundown of the Academy before, like, we just very, very quickly just read out one of your favourite quotes and break that down that's relevant to today a little as well. So, perhaps if you want to, what I'm going to do, Donald, I'm going to say we've got about 5 minutes max for you to just give what you like on some history of Marcus Aurelius, some little facts, trivia, or things that people can pick up, of course, in the book or can elaborate on further by reading it.
To say now a little bit about Marcus Aurelius. Well, I've just finished doing this graphic novel and then the more academic prose biography. I would say the things that...
And do throw out the names and say when they're out as well.
Well, the graphic novel's called Verissimus, and it's coming out in June, and then the prose biography is called Marcus Aurelius Ancient Life. It's by Yale University Press, and it's coming out probably in around about October, I think. So sometimes people say to me, did I change my mind about Marcus by writing these different sorts of books? And in some ways I did. I learned more. I think by writing the graphic novel, I gained a greater appreciation for how the Antonine Plague affected him. Because normally we mention that there was a big plague and then we move on and talk about the rest of his life. But when you visualize it, you realize that the plague was always there throughout the rest of his career as emperor. Most of his time as emperor, people, he was surrounded by death. And so I think this really transformed the atmosphere in Rome.
It probably made Stoicism even more sort of helpful for him.
Stoicism became kind of trendy at the time. And then mysteriously it sort of died off afterwards. And in the prose biography, the first couple of chapters are about Marcus Aurelius' mother and about the Emperor Hadrian. So I don't think people say enough about the influence that Marcus's mother had on him. She was an intellectual. She spoke fluent Greek. She surrounded herself with a circle of intellectuals. And she was a construction industry magnate, surprisingly. She was an unusually wealthy and independent Roman matriarch. She was an exceptional woman. And I think Marcus's mother, I think it's possible, I don't know this for sure, I'm just speculating now, I think there's a possibility that Marcus's mother was the one who introduced him to Stoicism. There's some possible...
Probably had a much bigger influence on his life than people
there's
think.
There's a hint that she was friends with Junius Rusticus. So it may be that she already knew these guys, and she would have been in charge of choosing Marcus's teachers. Marcus's teachers are mainly Stoics. So we could say his and behind every great man is a great woman kind of thing. It looks like his mum was the one saying, I want my son educated by all these famous Stoic teachers. And then Hadrian, you know, I don't think enough is said about the influence that Hadrian had. Hadrian was Marcus Aurelius' adoptive grandfather. I saw somebody wrote an Amazon review and they disagreed with me about this. They go, Marcus would barely have known Hadrian. Marcus lived with Hadrian for about 6 months, you know, just before Hadrian's death. So I think he knew him pretty well, actually. Hadrian chose Marcus from a very young age to kind of groom him as a potential successor. So Hadrian had a lot of influence over Marcus's upbringing. But Hadrian, towards the end of his life, went crazy and engaged in these violent political purges. And I think it's clear that Marcus is at best ambivalent about Hadrian and possibly saw him as becoming something of a tyrant towards the end of his life. So I think part of what motivated Marcus, part of Marcus's psychology is that as a young guy, he thought, I don't want to end up like Hadrian. How can I avoid doing that?
If he perceives him almost like a father figure, that's you know, obviously something that is true for all of us, really.
I think he turns to Stoicism as a way of preventing himself from ending up as crazy, paranoid, and tyrannical as Hadrian.
As soon as he noticed any of those similar emotions coming out or actions, he would then jump back and then think, hang on, what are we doing? Look at it.
Here's a little bit of trivia for you. And a little bit of historical trivia is I often say that Marcus Aurelius had a problem managing his anger. And so sometimes people say, well, how would you know that? Well, if you look closely, he actually tells us that at the beginning of the Meditations. He says in black and white that he had problems managing his anger at some point in life, probably his youth by the sounds of it, and that he was grateful to the gods that he never did anything that he might have regretted. And throughout the Meditations, you'll notice there are actually a surprising number of references to anger. There's one passage, 11:18, where he lists 10 separate cognitive strategies for managing anger, and then throughout the book, he returns to selections from that list. So one of the main themes in the Meditations is coping with anger, because he's told us that as a young man, he had problems managing his own anger.
I also don't doubt, and you know, perhaps partly why some of the themes do recur as well, is that he's sometimes doing this for himself. You know, he might be going through things in those stages of life. You know, there's quite a lot that comes up when you're ruling the Roman Empire and you're at war, you've got the plague and everything else to deal with. There may have been moments where he saw, I almost reacted then. I'm sitting writing something. He's almost reminding himself, not necessarily, because, you know, he was writing for himself, wasn't he, at the time? So
he was writing it on the Danube, on the frontier, in the middle of what he called the war, what the Romans called then, the War of Many Nations. And in the middle of the plague. And then he also, after he finished the Meditations, faced a civil war. So there's something I'll mention, actually, it's of interest about the way the Meditations is written. It's artfully vague. Someone got annoyed with me for saying that once, but I'll stand by that. It's surprising, in a way, that there aren't more. There are some specific references. to individuals or events. But generally, he's, especially for, if you, from a historian's perspective, a biographer's perspective, it's frustrating. I'll give you one example. One of the
I don't think it'd be as great, though, if it was so, so personal.
Well,
I
people think, wouldn't see themselves in the pages as much.
So a
simple example is Meditations 2.1, which is one of the most widely quoted passages. He says, every morning when you awake and tell yourself that you're going to meet treacherous, meddling, belligerent people and so on, and prepare to cope with them, right? He doesn't name any names, right? And he doesn't even give any kind of clues as to what sort of people he's talking about. So we read that and think, my mother-in-law's a bit like that. Oh, that guy that works in the desk across from me is a little bit like that.
Yeah.
You know, we can immerse ourselves in it and identify ourselves with it in a 100%. Way that we couldn't if he was being more specific.
Talking about someone specific in his army or something, yeah.
But as a biographer, obviously we read that and think he must at some level have in mind examples of people that he's talking about.
Yeah.
And he mentions treason. He's facing a civil war. He's faced a huge betrayal from Roman allies. It would be really interesting. And he's writing this in the middle of dealing with ambassadors.
If he wrote some notes to go with it all as well, the personal thing behind each story, that would be fascinating.
Yeah. So it's an interesting challenge to connect these kind of vague comments to the actual historical events that were happening around him as he wrote them. I mean, he may just be talking in that passage about one of his relatives that's kind of annoying. But he may also be talking about these seismic world history changing events that are going on around.
Yeah, there'll be something that's triggered it. Yeah, whether it's something personal, whether it's something he's witnessed in others or what have you, there's something that's going to trigger him to think, that's a good thing for me to sit and write, you know, and be fascinated if we could know what they were. But okay, before we go and pick your passage, obviously it's actually one of the reasons I reached out to you in the first place, because it was just pretty... like, amazed, really, to see that you're sort of bringing back a little bit of history of Athens yourself with sort of re-establishing, is that the right word? The sort of Plato Academy, based around the same grounds where the original one, disappeared, 1,800 years ago, something like that? So tell us a bit about that.
Well, Plato's Academy is, every single academy is named after it. So it's weirdly recognisable to people, even if they don't know anything else about it. It was the first academic institution, in a sense, in Western history. It was in a gymnasium, which is not what we call a gymnasium. Today, a gymnasium is like a building where you do sports and stuff. An ancient Greek gymnasium was more like a recreational ground. Like, it's a big... 30, 40-acre sports ground with running tracks, a palestra, a wrestling school, boxing. So young, mainly adolescents, would do these sports there, and older men would hang around and discuss politics and philosophy, if you can kind of imagine that, in this lush park with streams.
Sounds really interesting, really good.
So Plato would walk around. Also, Plato was buried there. Like, his tomb was there well. So when you're walking there now, it's a park today. But tourists don't go there. It's mainly Athenians that walk their dogs there and do taekwondo there and whatever they do. So, like, as you're walking around there, you might think, Plato's bones are maybe under the ground here. Like, Plato used to walk around here. Socrates probably also walked around there, and other philosophers doing philosophy. But there's not much philosophy that's done there anymore. So I thought, number one, wouldn't it be cool if people did more philosophy here? And number two, wouldn't it be good if more people knew about this? And number three, why isn't there an international conference center here? Like, it seems like the most obvious thing to do. Because also, it's a poor, economically deprived area. And Greece has been through a terrible economic catastrophe. And so, you know, the Greeks want to find ways that they can legitimately use their cultural assets to benefit their economy. And one of them would be if they brought businesses, tourists, to places like Plato's Academy Park, Academia Platonos, and bring foreign revenue and investment into
Greece.
Was this
the rhetoric that you used to get the...
Yeah, it seems pretty stupid, but the thing was, I started saying that. I thought, why don't you guys... You know, it's one of those ideas where you think, why isn't someone already doing this? I thought, it started off as me going, why have you guys not done this?
Yeah.
And then people started to say to me, why don't you do it? And I said, well, I don't know anything about building a conference, right? But then I realised that one of my friends does. Like, my good friend James O'Neill is a chartered surveyor. He specializes in these things. And then I realized I knew a bunch of other people who were involved in similar projects in Greece. And within a year, We had a business plan, a proposal, and we became part of an incubator program, and we got seed funding from a foundation in the UK, the Aurelius Foundation. And we started built a virtual community online that took off like a house on fire. And we are now organising a virtual conference in May with a bunch of senior academics speaking about it.
Like, excellent.
So we've got a board of advisors now with a bunch of...
Tell us where people can get more info. I know I'm on the Facebook group.
Just go. The website is just... Now, there are a bunch of other websites with similar names. Ours is platosacademy.org.
Okay.
So if they...
And there's the Facebook group as well, because I think you put out content on
there. Nearly 2,500 people in the Facebook group, and we only just started it up. So you can go to the Facebook group.
Yeah, because I think I remember when you started it.
Yeah, it was about a month ago, right? It took off, boom, and then on Twitter...
And that's just called Plato's Academy, isn't it? Is it just
Plato's Academy Centre is the the full name of the non-profit. I should say this is a non-profit. It's what the Greeks call a civil non-profit association, incidentally. So it's the idea...
So you've actually built something on the grounds there as well, then,
we're in the process of doing that. So what will happen is the Greek government have plans to build an open-air structure in the park, kind of store, but we're not... They haven't given us all the details yet. But there's going to be some events in the summer in the open air. And then we are in the process of acquiring property that we would then use as a conference facility. We're going to basically build a conference centre there. And in the meantime, we're building a virtual community. So we'll have virtual events. And then when the conference centre is ready, we'll have similar events there physically. But we are running events there already this September. For an organization, and it's not open to the general public, but in the future the events will be available to the public.
Brilliant. And guys, if you are listening, I would suggest certainly check out the website and do join the Facebook group as well, because even though I don't get to spend too much time on social media, I do browse from time to time, and there is some awesome content on there already. And you know, ultimately you've got the fascination with the history and everything else, but you're also doing some great things that, you know, help people, and ultimately that's what you do for your living, your sort of background anyway. So well worth looking at. Now... Just to finish up, so we've chatted for ages, which has been awesome. You know, hopefully, listeners have got some enjoyable content. Sure, they have. But I did, before we came on, I did ask Donald, like, just because of the nature of this show and how it normally works, to select a passage from Meditations of his choosing that's one of his favourites, but also perhaps gives some, you know, good sort of context for the life we live today. And it is actually... I think it was book 2, passage 17, wasn't it? So that is one that I'd have already covered on a previous show. So what I'm going to do, if you're all right with that, is I will just read out the passage.
Yeah.
And then you, if you're happy to, break it down and give some context on it, thoughts on it, and, you know, any relevance to how people can use it to improve their lives today. So here is the passage. In man's life, his time is a mere instant. His existence a flux, his perception fogged, his whole bodily composition rotting, his mind a whirligig, his fortune unpredictable, his fame unclear. To put it shortly, all things of the body stream away like a river. All things of the mind are dreams and delusion. Life is warfare and a visit in a strange land. The only lasting fame is oblivion. What thing can escort us on our way? One thing. And one thing only, philosophy. This consists in keeping the divinity within us inviolate and free from harm, master of pleasure and pain, doing nothing without aim, truth or integrity, and independent of others' action or failure to act. Further, accepting all that happens and is allotted to it as coming from that other source, which is in its own origin, and at all times awaiting death, with a glad confidence that it is nothing more than the dissolution of the elements of which living creatures are composed. Now, if there is nothing fearful for the elements themselves, in their constant changing of each into another, why should one look anxiously in prospect at the change and dissolution of them all? This is in accordance with nature, and nothing harmful is in accordance with nature. Good timing.
Yeah, you can hear my cat.
Yeah, he did, yeah. It's a beautiful passage, to be honest, and relevant to what we've touched on.
Maybe I can say something about that. So let's say something stylistically about it. So Marcus is a Stoic. The Stoics were ridiculed by ancient philosophers for having a kind of dry style of speaking because they were opposed to the style of rhetoric that the Sophists used, where they tried to manipulate people's emotions. The Stoics tried to be more objective. So other ancient authors said, well, that can make them boring speakers sometimes. Marcus studied rhetoric under actually the leading Sophist of his period, Herodes Atticus. He was the most famous Sophist and Greek orator during a period known as the Second Sophistic, when Greek sophistry became popular again at Rome. And he was a family friend of Marcus, and he trained him in rhetoric. Marcus, for many years, also trained under Fronto, who is a leading exponent of Latin rhetoric as well. So Marcus was a great rhetorician or speechwriter. Now, some people say they don't see that much evidence of that in the Meditations, because these are really just kind of informal notes. But occasionally it comes through. That passage, I think, is probably the best example in the Meditations of a very well-crafted, almost like a rhetorical exercise that might have been assigned by Fronto or Herodes Atticus.
You can always see him standing on a podium. Like, yeah,
it's a beautiful little speech, right? It's also a particular type of speech. It's what we would call a protractic or an exhortation to philosophy. So it's a speech that's basically trying to motivate and inspire others to embrace the life of philosophy. We call that protractic. Mm. And it's almost like a summary of the whole of Stoic philosophy. It starts off alluding to the view from above. It ends alluding to the contemplation of death. And then in between, there's lots of other aspects of Stoicism as well. On a historical note, many scholars have noted, he mentions there life is warfare and a sojourn or a trip in a foreign land. He wrote that because he says underneath it, at Carnuntum in Austria, this huge Roman legionary base on the Danube, on the frontier with Germania. And so Marcus was literally surrounded by warfare and in a foreign land when he wrote that passage. Mm-hmm. It seems, again, it's strange because it seems artfully vague, but when you think of where he's writing it, he's obviously referring at some level.
And that's, again, that's where that trigger would have come from, to use that as the metaphor, to use that as the analogy.
On the one hand, it's kind of a well-known metaphor. On the other hand, it clearly refers to the situation that he's physically in at the time he's writing it. So we can kind of get both. We can treat it as abstract and in general, and we can also treat it as resonating with the realities of his biography, his life. So there are many things. It's like we say, it starts off there with a view from above. It talks about really dedicating yourself to protecting the divinity within you, which is a little bit opaque. The Stoics, that means reason, basically. It means a faculty of moral choice.
I think that's something that you read the whole book and you pick it up.
It becomes clearer.
It still touches on it,
All of these are themes that he returns to again and again throughout the rest of the book. And then there's another point where he says that perception is missed. And the word he uses is tuphos, which is a technical term or a kind of a term of art in Cynic and Stoic philosophy. It means smoke or mist. And it's like we would say smoke and mirrors today. So the Stoics and the Cynic would say, look, the world of human opinions is all smoke and mirrors. Like, this is a cliche, you know. And he's using this terminology here. He's alluding to well-known philosophical tropes and reworking them into this quite dense, very powerful passage.
Yeah, I know. I think it's brilliant because, like you say, it does have so many different elements to it that will come to light, you know, in a passage of their own at different points as well. Brilliant. And thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for coming on, Donald, as well. It's been wonderful chatting. Could bloody talk about this stuff like all day.
That's great. I do talk about it all day. It's my hobby.
I bore enough people to death with it. I'm sure you do as well.
Guys,
thank you very much for listening. And Donald, thank you again for coming on, being an absolutely amazing guest and giving some awesome content for our listeners as well. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Adam.
And everybody, thank you for listening, and I will see you next time.